This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Brothers Rafe and Joseph Fiennes have each starred in Academy Award-winning films. Rafe played a Nazi in Schindler's List and was the romantic lead in The English Patient. Joseph Fiennes played Shakespeare in Shakespeare in Love. While both are reluctant to talk with interviewers about their lives, they're using their star power to call attention to the final book written by their mother, Ginny, who died of breast cancer in 1993 at the age of 55. I spoke to Rafe and Joseph Fiennes and their sister Sophie, a documentary filmmaker. Their mother's final novel, Blood Ties, is published under her pen name, Jennifer Lash. I asked Rafe Fiennes to tell us what it's about.
Violet Farr is Irish. She's married to her husband, the ineffectual Cecil, a repressed homosexual. And in a moment of joyless union, they conceive a son who is called Lumsden, but they are unable to show him any kind of love. He becomes a ne'er-do-well and fathers himself an illegitimate child, Spencer. And when this severely traumatized boy is dumped on Violet, his grandmother, he then becomes the focus for all the despair and disappointment that her son has loaded upon her.
You know, in the novel, the mother, Violet, considers her son dishonest, sexually deviant, a parasite, and a liar. And she thinks that he was cursed the night she gave birth to him. Rafe Fiennes, can I ask you to read an excerpt from your mother's book? And the scene I've chosen is a scene in which the son who she is so repelled by...
Lumsden.
Lumsden awakens from a dream, and he's dreaming about a stag. I just mentioned that because there's a reference to a stag in the reading. Mm-hmm. And he finds his mother at the foot of his bed, staring at him. Could you read the scene for us?
In the instant of waking, Lumsden realized that the great shadow at the end of the bed, blocking out all the lights, was his mother. He realized that her eyes, rather than the stag's, were beaming down onto him. He realized also that he must, whatever else happened, he must get to the loo. This sheet is filthy, like everything else about you. Violet tugged as she spoke, wrenching, as if she might peel and then discard the whole tiresome, unwholesome experience of her son. She must pull him out from this place, out from her mind, and out utterly from her heart. Not only do you completely disregard the household, just using it like a cheap hotel, you haven't even any common decency left in you. You lie as and when it suits you. Everything has to be for your pathetic convenience, your whim, your pleasure. You're without fibre of any kind. I despise you. Violet tugged again at the sheet which Lumsden desperately clung to. He was immensely curtailed from any real action by the pressing condition of his need to urinate. He had on the flimsiest pair of underpants. The sheet was his guard now, his real lifeline. Lumsden tugged against Violet. There was a moment of tension. The sheet was pulled as smooth as glass between them, and then it gave way. Dirty and old, it murmured, and then with a roar, it tore completely in two. Violet fell back, banging her head against the door. With the torn half of the sheet clasped to him, Lumsden leapt out of bed, past his moaning mother, into the sanctuary of the large, sunny nursery bathroom. He shot the bolt and stood at last, with a relief beyond description, in front of the white lavatory pan. As he relieved himself of the bulk and pressure of the urine, as it bubbled into a fine froth in the pan, he gradually became aware again of Violet's moaning and cursing on the other side of the bolted bathroom door. For an instant, as Lumsden pulled the plug, he felt unease, a niggling press of real worry. He had taken some loose change from her bag. He had taken a packet of sweet Afton from one of the men's jackets hanging up in the stables. But surely, in a real adult world, anywhere civilized, surely these would not be crimes, but simply a case of poorly organized logistics. Violet banged on the door. "Jesus wept," she screamed. "My head's bleeding, and all you can do is lock yourself into the bathroom. You should be thrashed. You should be thrashed." Lumsden did feel uneasy, but this woman was no longer his mother in the manner mothers sometimes seem to be with their sons. She was huge. She was animal. She was at bay, bellowing her own mad pain at him, and he simply would not receive it. He would never receive it. He would never allow himself to be a receptacle for the frantic, hopeless, shrieking pain of women. Never. Not in any circumstances.
That's Ralph Fiennes reading a passage from his late mother's last novel, Blood Ties. Well, here's a question to Ralph and Joe Fiennes. Was it odd for you to read your mother's novel about such a really disastrous mother-son relationship?
No. We obviously had an extraordinary, compassionate upbringing, and we were stimulated constantly by creative environment, and maybe it wasn't so much so for my mother. I think she was brought up in a very different environment, and possibly a lack of expression and love towards the children in her family, and that maybe, I don't know, informs the book.
Nothing about this relationship that I've just read is a reflection on our relationship, Sophie or Joseph or Martha or Jacob or our adopted brother Mick. We were loved intensely by my mother and our father. This relationship that I've just read to you is much more, I think, probably inspired by not anything specifically in her life, but you must know that her own childhood was very unhappy. Violet is not my mother's mother, not for a second. And nothing in this book is veiled autobiography. But she was very astute, my mother, at observing parent-child dysfunctional or mutual rejection, dysfunctional relationships.
I'm wondering, when your mother was sick, and she was, I think, diagnosed with cancer in 86 and died in 93, if there were times when she was sick and you really wanted to be with her, but you were torn between commitments to films and being with your mother. I think there are times for a lot of people when it's very difficult to figure out, just in the course of a long distance, how much time you can spend at home and how
You have there are three of us in the studio now, and there's six and children, seven if you include our adopted brother Mick, which we do include, and she definitely considered him as one of her seven children. And there was a huge support system for my mother when she was diagnosed as having cancer. Sophie, maybe you could talk a bit about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Ginny was a woman who was fascinated by being a mother, and she was compelled to be a mother, and she took it on board in a very sort of full-on way. But she was also, she had a very strong spiritual dimension to her. And in fact, when she was diagnosed terminally ill, she actually chose to spend a lot of time by herself, and I think that was a very important choice that she made. And we all had to respect that, which was actually quite difficult, but at the same time we knew that she was making a very conscious choice. And the pilgrimage is actually an extension of that kind of search that she felt she had to make for herself, within herself, that was sort of beyond even the, you know, the love and compassion and support of the family. And I think that that's something that, you know, is possibly an interesting, you know, choice that she made.
The pilgrimage you refer to is a pilgrimage she took toward the end of her life. It was a religious pilgrimage. She had been a Catholic but said that she no longer really practiced. What do you think she was looking for on this pilgrimage? And she did write a nonfiction book about the pilgrimage before she died.
Yes, she wrote a travel book because she decided when she was ill to make a pilgrimage, because really she was fascinated by you know, ancient places where people would have gone for centuries, and she was fascinated by religion and belief. And she was really a magpie for these things, and she had an excitement about the idea of faith and the idea of what she would refer to as a numinous deity. And she really went in a search to try to find her own relationship to that. And I think there's something that comes through very strongly in both books, which is her connection to nature and the practicality of life and the naturalness of that sort of practical aspect. So travelling and being en route and being in the process of a journey is, in a sense, a metaphor for the whole phenomenon of life itself. So she really enjoyed that, and I think the book has a lot of humour, and she comes through very strong on pilgrimage, personally, herself.
Did your mother have her demons too, and did you know about them when you were growing up?
Yes, we did.
what were they? How did they manifest themselves?
She was certified an incurable hysteric three times before she was 22, really because she was just very emotional as a child. And also she came from, this was in a period when mental health was regarded very differently to how it is regarded now. And she definitely was a highly emotional.
She was quite volatile. And, you know, she could fly off the handle unexpectedly.
Was she ever institutionalised?
Only briefly, when at this time Sophie's talking about. But I mean, no.
She was in her 20s.
But only, like, what, two nights or something.
It must have been confusing as children to have a mother who was so mercurial and whose mood could change suddenly.
Yes, but it was like a surface thing, because it never was a fundamental. We could witness one of her mood changes and know that it might be uncomfortable and sometimes even hurtful, but it didn't actually touch on fundamental love for us.
I think she was very articulate, you know, I think, to all the children about these demons, because it was the conflict of bringing up the children and allowing them and making us understand and participate in the kind of the stress of bringing up a family and trying to write books and paint and fulfill one's own artistic aspirations. So I think she was articulate, and I felt that we were very much aware of the pressure that she was under, and the silence that she needed amongst seven children.
My guests are actors Rafe and Joseph Fiennes and their sister documentary filmmaker Sophie Fiennes. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Rafe and Joseph Fiennes and their sister documentary filmmaker Sophie Fiennes. They're promoting the final novel by their mother Ginny, which has just been posthumously published in the U.S. It's called Blood Ties. Your mother was a writer and amateur painter. Your father was a photographer. I'm wondering if their...
Is still
a photographer. Yeah. Good. I'm wondering if their work made it easier for you, Rafe and Joe, and you, Sophie, as a filmmaker, to imagine yourselves going into the arts, you know, becoming performers or filmmakers. I think it's such a leap for some people who don't grow up in families or in neighborhoods in which there are artists to imagine becoming one themselves.
Well, I think we're very lucky that my mother was passionate about words, literature, ideas, the imagination. And she and my father also talked to us, discussion and conversation was encouraged. It wasn't even a self-conscious thing, it just was there, because my mother loved to talk about ideas and discuss books, ideas of films, plays, pieces of music. And she'd always come back from an event. If we were too young to have seen a certain film or gone to a certain concert, she would come back and say, we saw the most wonderful concert last night, the composer was such and such, or we saw an amazing play last night and there was this kind of play and the story is this. And I think we all were on the receiving end of this enthusiasm. So in that sense, I suppose it may be to choose to follow a career in what one, I suppose, we have to call the art, didn't seem a big step for us because of the nature of the environment that Ginny gave us.
Did you get to see much in the way of theatre or movies when you were growing up?
Yes. I think I can remember being taken to see Laurence Olivier's Henry V when I was about 5.
Well, yeah, what did you make of it at the age of 5?
I love the music by Sir William Walton. I love the battle scenes.
Uh-huh.
It was a great film. I mean, it's got such great cinematic energy that I think an alert 5-year-old can respond to it. It's such a brilliant piece of filmmaking. It's a proof that Shakespeare, you know, needn't be the stuff of O-level exams. That it's alive. It's a storytelling. You know, it's visual.
What else made a big impression on you as kids?
Well, I mean, I was just thinking of that. I remember being taken to see Waiting for Godot when I was 9 because she was a passionate Samuel Beckett fan.
Another children's favourite.
Yeah, exactly. I loved Lucky. I thought Lucky was a brilliant character.
It is. It's great. Vaudeville is wonderful. Broad comedy.
So, I think definitely her enthusiasm for creative work was something that was very inspiring for us to be a part of, and it's definitely conveyed.
With 7 kids in the house, did you get into a let's put on a show type of thing?
Well, I'm going to interject here because I remember as a sort of five-year-old being subjected to a seven-hour-long performance.
No interval.
Of a Pollux Theatre production.
It's a toy theatre.
Which is a toy theatre, like a sort of proscenium stage, that was produced, directed, and every single part played by Rafe. And I think there was Treasure Island and what was the other one? The Corsican Twins, was it?
The Corsican Brothers, Jack the Giant Killer. Cinderella.
We mustn't get him onto this. We should move on, basically.
It was a brilliant theatre because what he'd done is he'd made little footlights in tiny matchboxes. So there were actually footlights at the bottom of the theatre in the cut-out characters, which were on attached to little wire poles that got moved in and out of the, in front of the proscenium. It was brilliant.
I've still got it. I'm doing a show next week.
How long is it going to be?
We'd like to come on the radio and talk.
8 hours.
He's not really plugging plug ties.
Joe, you have a twin brother. Is he an identical or fraternal twin?
Fraternal. Very, very different. He's a bit taller, blue eyes, blonde hair.
Why is everybody laughing?
Describing as he's sort of the Aryan-looking one. and Jake went in a very different way. Moved into wildlife, was compelled and fascinated by wildlife at an early age.
Tell a story about Adam and Eve.
Well, there was, I think as twins, although it wasn't too bad for us. Oh, God, okay. We were labelled as the twins, although encouraged very much to be individual. But obviously, when you're young and together and paired off at school, you are constantly fighting to find your individualism. And so I remember a time in Ireland when we had moved there at the age of four. I think we were camping with my mother and father, and Ginny told us, it was an early, wonderful, beautiful, misty morning, and Ginny told Jake and I to go and wash in the stream. It didn't really appeal to four, five-year-olds too much, and so she, in order to invoke us to do this, she said we should play out the roles of Adam and Eve, and we took the bait and thought this was rather glorious and wonderful. So we ran off bounding down to the down the meadow to the stream, but only moments later there was a God Almighty row, and there was a terrible fight broke out, and it seemed that there was some confusion or an issue rather with the casting, because neither of us wanted to play Eve. And I guess that was the first moment in our lives when we discovered how to fight for our individualism.
And for the best parts.
Absolutely, and for the best. I think I should have taken up the challenge, really. It might have opened up my range at an early age.
There's still time.
So who were you finally?
Well, I'm now going to try and pursue any roles, female roles, like Eve. Now.
Well, this could have been good preparation for Shakespeare in Love, when, you know,
all
the women's
absolutely.
Parts went to men. Yeah,
yeah,
I think
exactly.
That's what your mother had
British,
in mind.
It's a great British tradition, cross-dressing.
That's right. Well, Joseph Fiennes did get to cross-dress for a scene in Shakespeare in Love, in which his character, William Shakespeare, decides to accompany his lover, played by Gwyneth Paltrow, to a gathering without the knowledge of her fiancé, played by Colin Firth.
Good morning, my lord.
My lady, the tide waits for no man, but I swear it would wait for you.
Oh, here we come at last, my lord.
Are you bringing your laundry woman?
A chaperone, my lady's country cousin. My, but you be a handsome gallant. Just as she said, you may call me Miss Wilhelmina.
On a more fortuitous occasion, perhaps.
Oh, my lord, you will not shake me off. Ah, she never needed me more. I swear by your breeches.
We'll be back with more from the Fiennes after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are actors Rafe and Joseph Fiennes, and their sister, documentary filmmaker Sophie Fiennes. Rafe, you were the first in the family to get into film. It sounds like you knew pretty young that you wanted to be an actor?
Well, a mother who loved theatre and loved performance and had herself talk to us about having seen the likes of John Gielgud, Paul Scofield, Richard Burton on stage, and the passion with which she discussed told me the memories of seeing these actors, I really listened. It really excited me, and I know that wanting to be an actor was definitely rooted in her shared passion for the theatre.
Riff, can I ask what her reaction was when you told her that you were going to play a Nazi in Schindler's List and work with Spielberg?
She read the script and she thought that it was a brilliant script and that the character I was about to play was a tragic character, really. I think she thought that Steve Zalian's writing of this part was particularly rounded and perceptive and sad, actually. I think that, yeah, her reaction was that it was that the script overall was brilliant, and that the part was a wonderful opportunity for any actor.
But why don't I play a scene from Schindler's List? And this is a scene in which Ray Fiennes, you know, as a Nazi, is speaking to a young, attractive Jewish woman to whom he realizes he's very attractive. And he starts speaking to her in a way that is surprising, considering he's a Nazi.
I would like so much to reach out and touch you in your loneliness. What would that be like, I wonder? I mean, what would be wrong with that? And I realize that you're not a person in the strictest sense of the word, but I mean, well, maybe you're right about that too. You know, maybe what's wrong isn't, it's not us. It's you know, it's this. I mean, when they compare you to vermin and to rodents and to lice, I just no. You make a good point. Make a very good point. Is this the face of a rat? Are these the eyes of a rat? Hath not a Jew eyes?
That's Ray Fiennes from Schindler's List, and after that comparatively sensitive moment, he blames the young Jewish woman for trying to seduce him, and because he's so horrified that he's attracted to a Jew, he's so upset by the thought of it, that just as he's about to tenderly touch her, he instead erupts into a fit of anger and starts violently beating her up. Did your mother have any reaction to seeing that scene, or to seeing this kind of... To seeing you play such a really violent and an unempathetic personality?
Well, I can't remember exactly what she said. She was very ill at that time, and she had to be taken in a wheelchair to the screening. And she found it very hard to speak because the breath, her lungs were very badly affected by the cancer. So I can only remember her just being full of praise and being very affected, actually, by the whole film, as so many people were. I think, though, what's interesting in Blood Ties...
This is her novel.
Yeah, in Blood Ties, you know, what she understands is that violence in somebody can behave... There is the potential for I use the word warily, but there is potential for redemption. And in the character of Spencer, the reader meets a young boy totally rejected, almost from the moment of his birth, who could be very violent. And she never, you know, he's definitely, he cuts off. He cuts off from people. He doesn't communicate. He becomes isolated and detached. You know, all his feelings are dead. But what I find moving about the book is that you are led, the reader is led into understanding how this came about, and also then witnessing the potential for someone to change. And I want just to read you the very beginning of The Pilgrimage, because she touches on this in the first two paragraphs. It starts off, it's not long, "Poor cancer. The word is dark and terrible, full of fear to the medical profession as much as anyone else. I believe it is a constellation. You become simply one of thousands and thousands of stars within it. It is a common, everyday disease. A star may be sharp and full of pain, but it may also be a guide, a useful companion on a dark night. There is a hidden current within every individual. It seeks and stirs, hides and yearns. Sometimes it is bewildered, a mixture of anger and pain and certainty. It may recede, but it never escapes. In moments of crisis, it is often full of voice.
You know, in the studio now, we have three members of the Fiennes family all here to speak on their late mother's behalf. And I'm wondering if her sickness brought you closer together, or perhaps you were already very close.
Already very close, I think.
Yeah, we're very close in age, and of course it brings, I think, it did bring us together in a way, particular way, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you all very much for speaking with us about your mother. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
Rafe Joseph and Sophie Fiennes. Their mother's final novel is called Blood Ties. It's published under her pen name, Jennifer Lash.